Hello.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is Donna Crow, and this show is dedicated to your excellent health, and we're here today to talk about curing diabetes, if it's possible to do it, and if it is, how do you do it? Our special guest today is I was going to call him doctor. He's not a doctor. He's a mister. Mr. Thomas Smith. And he himself was diagnosed at the age of 65 with diabetes. And he went on his own journey to cure himself naturally. And he's 81 now, and he's been diabetes-free this entire time. And I see a number in my switchboard. I'm going to check and see if that's Mr. Smith, make sure I've got the right person here. So hold on, everybody. Hello, Mr. Smith, are you there?
Yep, hi. You
Okay, good. I got the right person.
Okay,
so
is this
I'm gonna
telephone
ask you
okay?
To hang. Yeah, it's very good. We can hear you clearly.
The reason is I had a better telephone, but it was not a dial. It was a dial telephone.
Well, this is good. Everybody can hear you good, I'm sure, as clearly as I can.
Okay.
So I'm just going to talk here a little bit about diabetes, and then I'll hand it over to Mr. Smith. If you already have diabetes, you may not be interested in these statistics, but if you don't have it, you might be interested. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit. For instance, if you go back 20 years, about 2% of all the cases of diabetes type 2 were in people between the age of 9 and 19. Now the number of people with diabetes between the age of 9 and 19 is 30% to 50%. It's gone up hugely. So young people, you know, we used to think this was a disease of old people, but now young people are having it in masses. We've had a 70% rise in the number of people with diabetes in the age group of 30 to 39. Since in just a 10-year period, we have that. In the same 10-year period, we had a rise of 40% in the age group of 40 to 49 and a 31% rise in the age group of 50 to 59. I was looking at information on the net recently, and I was looking at stuff that was just 10 years old, and they were saying, oh, my gosh, this is an epidemic. We've got, like, 12% diabetes in the population. And now, 10, 15 years later, they're saying it's at 29%. Literally one in every three people is having diabetes. I mean, this is like an epidemic that is causing incredible devastation in people's lives. We're talking about an illness that is responsible for the number one cause of blindness in the U.S., number one cause of amputation in the U.S., number one cause of kidney failure in the U.S., and it's an illness that is preventable and treatable. All right, so let's go on here. Dr. Arlen Rosenblum, who's a pediatric endocrinologist in Gainesville, Florida, says diet and exercise could reduce the rate of type 2 diabetes in children by 60 to 80%. I gave you the quote already in the mail-up that I sent out announcing this broadcast, telling you that Dr. Mercola says it's virtually 100% treatable and 100% preventable. And yet, people are going blind, they're losing their limbs, they're losing their organs, and prior to that point, they're suffering intensely, incredible pain, wounds that won't heal. It's just an astounding amount of suffering that goes on with diabetes. When you read Mr. Smith's book, you learn that it's not just that. We're looking at heart disease, cancer, a number of things being related to diabetes or related to improper insulin utilization in the body. I want to read you a few. First of all, I'm going to read you a few quotes from the U.S. Dietary Goals and Guidelines. And it says, ischemic heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and hypertension are the diseases that kill us. They are epidemic in our population. We cannot afford to temporize. we have an obligation to inform the public of the current state of knowledge and to assist the public in making the correct food choices. To do less is to avoid our responsibility. It goes on to say, there's a widespread and unfounded confidence in the ability of medical science to cure or mitigate the effects of such diseases once they occur. Appropriate public education must emphasize the unfortunate, I want you to really hear this, appropriate public education must emphasize the unfortunate but clear limitations of current medical practice in curing the common killer diseases. Once hypertension, diabetes, arteriosclerosis, or heart disease are manifest, there is, in reality, very little that medical science can do to return a patient to normal physiological function. As awareness of this limitation increases, the importance of prevention will become all the more obvious. So this is the U.S. government saying, once this ball gets rolling in your body, the medical people don't have an answer. One more quote from that. It says, as a nation, we have come to believe that medicine and medical technology can solve our major health problems. The role of such important factors as diet in cancer and heart disease has long been obscured by the emphasis on the conquest of these diseases through the miracles of modern medicine. Treatment, not prevention, has been the order of the day. And so this report is calling for a change of all that. They're calling for a return to intelligence in your diet, you know, and eating properly. And okay, so we have Mr. Smith here today. Mr. Smith cured himself of diabetes and has helped multitudes of people do the same thing. He wrote a book about it, Insulin, Our Silent Killer. So I'm going to read a few quotes to you from that, and then I'm going to introduce him officially and let him take the reins here. The very first page in the book, the abstract says, this report fully documents the nature of these diseases, describes the way the blood sugar control system works, identifies the role of insulin, defines the steps to a complete cure, and describes the preventive precautions needed to stay disease-free. All right, another quote. Hyperinsulinemia. I'll have to have him tell us how to pronounce that, as well as the list of degenerative diseases discussed, are well understood to be lifestyle diseases of fatty degeneration and nutritional deficiency. They are epidemic because we look to sales agents for food manufacturers to help us make our food choices. When we start making rational food choices ourselves, without their help, this entire degenerative disease epidemic will come to a screeching halt. So we've already heard that the government agrees with Mr. Smith here. Another quote, it is not unusual for the advanced type 2 diabetic to be simultaneously taking many different synthetic medications. They are needed to compensate for faulty liver function, kidney function, blood pressure, high cholesterol, as well as other systemic problems. This represents a financial bonanza for the drug companies, and for the medical establishment, it represents a disaster for the diabetic. This is why I was willing to face the unknown to cure myself rather than submit to this treatment rationale. And one final quote. Fortunately, there exists an alternative healing methodology that quickly cures type 2 diabetes completely, permanently, naturally, and economically. So that's about as good as it gets. Completely, permanently, naturally, and economically in the vast majority of cases. Without the need for endless treatment, we will discuss this issue and present the alternative methodology when we discuss the recovery program. So this is the good news. The bad news is diabetes is a devastating malfunction of our body. And the good news is it's preventable and it's treatable, and you can do it in the privacy of your own home. The power is in your hands. You can do it. And So we want you to know the good news today, and that is that you can deal with this. You can do it. You can take back the power in your life, in your health. You can make wise choices, simple choices, wholesome choices. You can get back on track in your diet, and you can be satisfied. I know people immediately think, yeah, but what am I going to have to eat? Is it just going to be awful and boring and terrible? No. I would venture to say if you had the good fortune to go to France and hang out there for a month and eat, you would think, wow, this food is really, really good. And they have way less diabetes than we do because of their diet. Same thing if you went to the Mediterranean. You will find people living happy, fulfilled lives, loving the food that they're eating, having very little diabetes. As the American diet begins to flood the world, then those other nations begin to see an increase in diabetes. So the deal is you can eat well. You can eat good. You can eat gourmet food, delicious food, and not have diabetes. You just have to know ratios and some very simple things. And he covers that in his book. I highly encourage you to get this. We'll talk about it a little bit later about how you can get a hold of that. So I'm going to quit yammering here and hand it over to Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith, thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate your time and just loved reading your book, loved the information in it. I've looked at so many other diabetic books that were just barely gave you enough information. Your book is just so empowering because it tells you exactly how your blood sugar control system works and it takes all the mystery out of it. Most of the other books I've read just give you a tiny bit of information, and it still is so mysterious that you feel sort of powerless in the situation. Your book is very empowering, and that's why I went looking for you and found you and wanted my listeners to hear you. So thank you for being here, and I'm just going to hand the mic over to you and let you take it from here.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, Donna. It's a great pleasure to be here. Anytime I get a chance to sound off about what diabetes is all about, I really like to have it.
I'm glad you're here.
In 1965, I'm a basic research engineer, research and development engineer. And for 38 years, I've practiced that craft, and I eventually ended up as president of my own company and contracting with various people who needed such services. And in 1965, I was commuting to Denver, Colorado, which was a distance of about 75 miles one way. And I was doing this 6 days a week, putting in 10-hour days down there. I was running two major development programs for the company. I never had a care in the world. My wife and I live here on a little goat farm. We were raising goats, and life was pretty neat. Until one day, I just plain ran out of gas. We talked about things, and I without even realizing it, I'd gained about 30 pounds. I was getting overweight. All my energy level had disappeared. I was always running to the bathroom. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't have much confidence in doctors because I'd watched them kill too many of my friends with poor treatment. But nevertheless, I didn't have anything else to do, so I went down to see the doctor. He took one look at me. You know, when you go to see the doctor, he weighs you, and sometimes he takes a blood sample. He started writing his prescription. He said I had diabetes. Well, I had no idea what diabetes is. When he finished writing the prescription, though, I asked him, I says, will this cure diabetes? He says, this is the prescribed treatment. Oh, boy. I didn't become successful as a research engineer by being gullible.
I would like to interrupt here. Can I interrupt just for 1 second? I think it's fascinating that you, a very intelligent person, a man of the world, out there in the business world, moving and grooving, in 1965 when you're diagnosed with diabetes, you didn't even know what it was. That, to me, is such a statement of, I mean, everybody knows about diabetes now because so many people have it.
I didn't. I was, the only medical things we were ever concerned with around here was we every once in a while have to get a vet out here to take care of one of our goats.
Yeah.
Neither one of us had any.
I just had to interrupt because I just thought that was such an amazing statement that you didn't even know what it was. I venture to say you could stop anybody on the street these days and ask them, have you heard of diabetes? Do you know what it is? Most people would know. It's a blood sugar issue, you know.
Well,
so anyway, go ahead.
We threw the TV set out of our house about 20 years before then, so we didn't have a TV around to brainwash us about what we're supposed to think. And so I was just out of touch, except with the things we were focused on. We're pretty much out of touch. When he said diabetes,
so.
I was wondering what it was, and he explained it. And then when I went down to the public library with his prescription in my hand, I had to get him to spell stuff out for me because the prescription was so sloppily written.
And you asked him, "Is this going to cure me?" And he just said, "This is the prescribed treatment, right?"
Yeah, that covered his butt, but didn't do me any good at all.
Okay.
Anyway, I went down to the library, looked it up, found out, boy, I don't want to take this stuff. A bunch of synthetic chemistry that was known to have very severe liver damage. So, boy, that really handed us a problem. Boy, if I sat at the kitchen table and looked at each other, by that time I found out what diabetes was. When I was down there, I looked it up and I found out what it does, you know. You can go blind, you can suffer kidney failure, you know, virtually the whole raft of diseases, 20 or 30 major diseases, heart failure, coronary artery disease. So I didn't really know a whole lot of what to do. It was my wife that came up with the idea. She said, well, you're a research engineer, research. At that point, I didn't even understand most of the medical terminology. I had to go buy a medical dictionary. And I found myself running down to the university library in Fort Collins in Boulder, Colorado, with my medical dictionary in one hand and a notebook in the other, taking notes. In those days, I carried a pocket full of dimes so I could make Xerox copies of important papers. The first thing I had to learn was how to read scientific papers in the medical business. About 90% of them were absolutely worthless. They're either written by the pharmaceutical companies to promote some drug, or they're written by somebody whose only interest is in inflating his own reputation. So I learned how to skim these articles and skim these abstracts and dig for the meat and potatoes that I was looking for. It took a while. It took almost 3.5-4 months.
Yeah, it's not the time of the internet where you could just go online and you know, Google it.
Well, I was online. I went online on the internet and PubMed and Medline.
Well, you obviously did that quite a bit later because 65, that wasn't available, you know.
But the problem with Medline and PubMed on the internet is they're kind of censored, and it's actually harder to find what you're looking for.
Wow.
And another problem is when you find something on the internet, you typically only see part of the abstract. And if you want to find out what's going on, you've got to get the paper. And so you've got to get it through, basically there's a service called Lonesome Doc where you can work with your local public library and they will order for you the journal papers that you need. So I collected a lot of papers. Gradually I put the story together and found out what was going on. And the more I found out about diabetes and what it was and how it worked, and as soon as I discovered something, I put it into effect in my life, and that was the proof of the pudding. Well, to cut the long story short, it took about 3.5 months before I could get full control of my blood sugar. My blood sugar, when I started this, I didn't know really what it was, because it would peg our meter. We bought one of these glucose meters, and the meter only went up to 360 milligrams per deciliter. And I would take my blood sugar, and it would peg the meter. It would say error. So it was off scale. It was above 360. So anyway, I start putting into effect the things I learned. Gradually, blood sugar started dropping down. It took about 3.5 months, and I got it down to normal, which was around 100 milligrams or 90 milligrams per deciliter. But
had a real sense of victory at that time.
Yeah, I was so focused at what I was doing, though. I didn't sense that I had really won anything. I was just, after a while, it became just like like any other research project, and I was looking to see results, and I was measuring the quality of my research by the results I got. But we finally got the blood sugar under control. So I told a few other people about what I was doing and what happened, and my body weight started to drift down a little later. It took a while longer for the body weight to come down, and that bothered me too, because I didn't like being overweight. I was all my life I've been a trim, 155, 160 pounds, 5'11", and I didn't like weighing 180 pounds. So it took a lot longer for my weight to come down, so I had to research that a little bit, and that's where I found the insulin connection to body weight. Insulin, besides being a fundamental catalyst for sweeping blood sugar out of your bloodstream, insulin does a lot of other things in your body too, one of which is manufacture fat and store fat. So when you have a lot of insulin, excess insulin in your bloodstream, it triggers your liver to manufacture fat, and then it triggers your adipose cells, your fat storing cells, to store the fat. So if you're gaining weight, or if you're overweight, it's absolute prima facie evidence that you're hyperinsulinemic. You have too much insulin in your system, way too much, because it takes insulin to make you fat, and without it, you won't be fat. So
I think this is why they've coined the phrase diabesity, because they go together.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But which gets us into some of the more subtleties of how the blood sugar. In your body, you have a system, a blood sugar control system. And the whole idea of it is to manage your blood sugar. You've actually got two of them. The primary energy producing fuel for the body is carbohydrates. The secondary energy producing material for the body is fats, stored fats. And what happens is when you eat carbohydrates, you have a whole system, internal system, swings into action and starts dealing with these carbohydrates. Like I said, you got two systems. One system is located entirely in your brain, and the other system operates the rest of your body. The system that operates your brain produces its own insulin and helps and uses glucose to operate your brain. Your brain runs on glucose. Your brain will not run on fats, which is the secondary fuel for the body. It only runs on glucose, or glutamic acid, which is a derivative. So that's the first glucose control system, blood sugar control system you got. It's in the brain. And it works only on the brain. Second one you got operates with all the rest of your body. It controls the glucose in the bloodstream that supplies all the 70 trillion cells in your body. And you got an intricate system here, a whole bunch of different components working together in order to get that glucose into the cell, into each of the 70 trillion cells in the body. This is what makes the cell, this is what powers the cells. This is where the cells get their energy. The primary conversion mechanism, intracellular, converts glucose into ATP. ATP is the energy molecule that powers your muscles and everything. So the control mechanism is used to eventually see that the glucose that you eat in your blood, in your carbohydrates, eventually gets to the mitochondria inside the cell. Each cell has a couple of thousand or more of these mitochondria, up to 10,000 of them, and they all act like little powerhouses. And the glucose that comes in is like the coal that comes into a electric generating plant. It's burnt for energy. So this control mechanism that controls getting this glucose into the cell, it's a failure of this mechanism causes diabetes. This is what gets diagnosed as diabetes. Well, this mechanism consists of the blood pathway that carries the glucose around. It consists of the alpha cells in the pancreas that sense how much insulin you got or how much insulin you need in your bloodstream. The beta cells, which secrete insulin into the bloodstream. It consists of the membranes, the cellular membranes that surround each of the cells. It consists of GLUT4 transporters inside the cell from the mitochondria that come out to the inner surface of the cell membrane to get the glucose when they're summoned to do so by insulin signaling. This is just a lot of different components to this. And diabetes will manifest when one or more of these things isn't working right. Because the end result of getting the glucose into the cell doesn't happen. And so that's the diabetes that we're trying to home in on.
So that was the source of the fatigue that you were feeling, is because that blood sugar control system was not working and the glucose was not getting into the cells and being used like it's supposed to. So you essentially ran out of steam.
Just ran out of steam. That's one of the early symptoms of it. Another early symptom of it is you're always running to the bathroom to urinate because the glucose stays in your bloodstream, you're going to a high urination mode in order to get that blood sugar down, because blood sugar causes elevated blood sugar for prolonged periods of time, cause all the small capillaries throughout your body to start leaking. Now, this is what eventually causes blindness. This is why when you get a bruise or something, it doesn't heal real quickly. All your little capillaries start leaking. The capillaries in your kidneys start leaking, and this suffers kidney damage. So your body tries to get rid of this glucose. It can't get it into the cells in a normal way, so it tries to get rid of it by high urination. Well, as a side issue, I might point out that when you get into this mode, you have a very high insulin level and a very high glucose level and no energy. I think I'll digress a little bit at this point and discuss a little bit about some of the medications, the synthetic medications, and why they're so terrible. One of the medications inhibits the effect of the amylase enzymes in your intestine. And these enzymes are the ones that are necessary to digest carbohydrates. So one of the synthetic medications that the doctor offers you is a way to prevent yourself from being able to digest carbohydrates to produce glucose. Now, this will, of course, lower the blood sugar, but it doesn't do it in the right way. It lowers blood sugar by making sure it never gets into the bloodstream, instead of lowering blood sugar by making sure it does get into the cell. Another one of these so-called medications of the doctors causes you to produce more insulin. Well, you're already having too high insulin levels, so producing more insulin just burns out your pancreas, has a very negative effect. And the third major class of diabetic medications prevents your liver from dumping sugar into the bloodstream. Whenever you eat carbohydrates, part of this blood sugar control system causes your liver to store about a third of the sugar, blood sugar that you eat, the carbohydrates that you eat. Your liver will store about a third of them in the liver as animal blood sugar. And then in between meals, when you start to get hungry, your blood sugar control system will typically cause your liver to dump this sugar into the blood. This is why a lot of diabetics can't understand why their blood sugar is too high, even though they haven't eaten anything. Well, the reason is because one of the problems that go wrong with the blood sugar control system is that your liver has got a high set point for what the blood sugar should be. And whatever gets below that high set point, it dumps extra sugar into the blood, whether you've eaten anything or not. Typically, your liver stores about 12 to 14 hours worth of blood sugar. So the third synthetic medication, interferes with the liver's ability to dump this blood sugar into the bloodstream. So if you think for a minute of what this synthetic medication is actually doing to your body, every single one of the theories underlying these three classes of medication is totally bogus. It's totally wrong. It shouldn't be that way. There's only one.
It's not fixing anything. It's just disrupting further.
Yeah. It's disrupting your body even worse than it was before you had high blood sugar. It's causing worse effects in your body than the blood sugar alone. So much for the diabetic medications.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the statement that you made before you started talking about the medications was that, you know, high blood sugar and high insulin, you're basically saying that's what diabetes is in your body. So a lot of people are going to be under the impression that diabetics don't have enough insulin. And
no,
that's
no,
why
no.
Some di-
no, no, no.
So can you explain that?
When you start to produce diabetes, your blood sugar control system wants to continue to work to regulate your blood sugar. And it does this by dumping out more and more insulin. And so in the years before diabetes gets diagnosed when your blood sugar gets above 126 milligrams per deciliter. That's the politically correct number now. The physiologically correct number is 90 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. But when you, as a result of a really poor diet, your blood sugar starts to drift up. Your body tries to keep it normalized, and it does this by dumping out more and more insulin. Well, pretty soon you're running very, very high levels of insulin throughout your body. But if you were to test your blood sugar, or the doctor were to test your blood sugar, no sign of diabetes because your blood sugar is normal. What happens is you're hyperinsulinemic. It's taking a great deal more insulin to maintain normal blood sugar than it should take. Well, what's the downside on this? Well, the downside is it makes you fat. All that extra insulin makes you fat. Another downside is all that extra insulin damages your arteries, particularly your coronary artery. And the reason it damages your coronary artery, because it's the first major artery connected to the portal vein where the insulin gets dumped into the bloodstream. And so you have the very highest levels of sugar and insulin in the coronary artery. This is why coronary artery becomes inflamed. Insulin is a very powerful corrosive kind of material, and in very high, chronically high levels, it'll damage your arteries. This is why during the 1930s, before they reorganized the whole medical community into the different specialty groups that they have now, back in the 1930s, it was commonly understood that coronary artery disease and heart failure was a symptom of diabetes. In fact, they used it to diagnose diabetes sometimes. Back in those days, they didn't have glucose meters. And initially, the doctor used to take a drop of your urine and put it on his tongue to find out if it was sweet or not. If it was sweet, he'd diagnose diabetes. Then they developed some chemistry, little drops of chemistry. You drop a few drops of it into a little bit of urine, and if it turned a certain color, it meant too much sugar was in your urine. That's how they used to diagnose diabetes. It wasn't until probably, 60s or so or later that glucose meters were developed. But anyway, the hyperinsulinemia that precedes diabetes precedes it by years, because simply by having elevated levels of insulin, you can maintain normal blood sugar levels for maybe 5, 6, 10 years sometimes before you finally get diagnosed with diabetes. And then you get diagnosed with diabetes because your pancreas, your insulin resistance, that is the resistance of all your cells in your body to the insulin signal telling it to take glucose out of the bloodstream, this insulin resistance finally becomes so high that no amount of insulin will cause enough sugar to be swept out of the bloodstream. So that's pretty much...
So basically what's happened is you've had such high insulin for so long from your body trying to control the blood sugar levels that your cells, in a sense, get fatigued and they stop responding to insulin. So that's what insulin resistance is?
Yeah, insulin resistance is an inability, basically it's the inability of the cells throughout your body to sweep the glucose out of the bloodstream when triggered by insulin. Insulin is a signaling mechanism. Actually, the way it works here is when insulin appears in the bloodstream with glucose, the insulin will bind to insulin receptors on the surface of the cell. A healthy cell has 3,000, 5,000, 6,000 of these receptors throughout, scattered all over the surface of the cell. And when insulin binds to these receptors, that's a signal to the cell. It initiates a biochemical chain reaction inside the cell. It's got about 2,000 links in this chain, and they're all enzymes and mineral dependent. So the first thing that can go wrong to produce insulin resistance is you can have key mineral deficiencies, so that when insulin binds to the cell and it tries to trigger this biochemical chain reaction to summon the GLUT4 transporters from the mitochondria up to the cell membrane to get the sugar, the chain's broken because you don't have key minerals in your system. So that's one of the first things that can go wrong with it, that caused insulin resistance. Another thing that goes wrong, and perhaps goes wrong is just as often, if not more so, when the GLUT4 transporters come up from the mitochondria to get the insulin into the cell and come to the cell membrane, they land on the inner surface of the cell membrane in random areas because they come from random locations within the cell. There's probably 3,000 mitochondria, all of which send GLUT4 transporters out to get glucose as soon as they receive the mineral-mediated signal to do so. Well, these GLUT4 transporters find themselves on the inner surface of the cell membrane, and so they have to migrate through the cell membrane to special little areas called cavallari areas. And this is where they pick up the glucose. These cavallari areas look like little dimples on the cell. And there's a few thousand of them. Well, this whole process, something, anything that can go wrong at any step of this process is going to produce insulin resistance. If, for example, mitochondria don't send enough glucose transporters out for one reason or another, usually it's because of a mineral deficiency, or they get to the cell membrane and then they can't migrate to the cavallari areas, which is a fatty acids problem. This is why omega-3 fatty acids become so important. Or if you have insufficient number of insulin receptors, once you get into this diabetic syndrome and you start running elevated levels of insulin and elevated levels of blood sugar and the cells can't do anything about it, it's like as far as the cell is concerned, it's like a telephone that won't stop ringing. And just like you would do if you had a telephone at home that didn't stop ringing, eventually you'd take it off the hook.
Right.
Well, these cells essentially do the same thing. What happens when they find themselves in a situation where there's lots of insulin and lots of sugar, but they can't seem to get it into the bloodstream, they can get it out of the bloodstream into the cell, they start decreasing the number of insulin receptors on the outside of the membrane. And that, you know, 3 to 5, 8,000 insulin receptors might drop down to 1,500.
Wow.
So now you've got a full-blown case of insulin resistance. You got plenty of insulin there, but you lack enough insulin receptors to get enough of the cell's attention to get enough glucose swept out of the bloodstream. Am I making sense?
Absolutely. And so can this be turned around?
Oh, yeah. Most of this can all be turned around.
All right.
First of all, you turn around the mineral issue.
Yes.
Making sure you have good minerals. Chromium, vanadium, help, zinc, magnesium, calcium, all of these are all minerals. And they're essential minerals, and they're the kind of minerals that are not added by the farmer to his ground when he plants his crops. And because they're no longer, all the farmland is so terribly depleted, most of the key minerals that you need no longer appear in your food supply in any useful quantity. You must supplement, or you will do without. So that's one of the key things you want to do is correct your mineral deficiencies.
Yes, we've talked about this privately, that every single biological function in your body requires an enzyme, and every single enzyme requires a mineral tag that basically essentially tells it what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're low on minerals, trace minerals, you know, and the macro and the micro minerals, you've shot yourself in the foot right from the get-go. And as you said, our soil is so low. You know, they've done studies on modern food, and they have studies on food, say, from the 50s, and you can look at the level of minerals in broccoli in the 50s and the level of minerals in broccoli now, and I think the numbers are just outrageous. Like, you'd have to eat, like, 50 pounds of broccoli to get what you get in 1 pound of broccoli now, then.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're just so depleted, and, they're fortified milk and various things like that, but it's just not enough. You really have to supplement if you want to be healthy, or you have to know your farmer and know that they are supplementing the soil and that the food that you're getting is nutrient dense. If you're not in that situation, if you're just going to the grocery store and getting it, you've got to supplement.
Oh, yeah.
So besides minerals, what else?
Well, the mineral deficiency will typically show up. It shows up in a lot of places, but one of the key places it shows up is in the GLUT4 summoning mechanism. These GLUT4 transporters are like little trucks. They come out from the mitochondria and they get into the cavaloidy area and they go essentially park there. And the cavaloidy area dimple fills up with crystallized glucose, which will tend to crystallize and collect there. And it collects. It's a little molecular truck. So it'll connect up with the glucose molecules and take them back down to the mitochondria. Well, this whole process, in the absence of minerals, the GLUT4 transporter never made it. They got stuck in the membrane, and they never made it. And so they can't get the glucose. The glucose stays in the bloodstream. So that's certainly one of the really important things to do. Well, suppose you get the inner portion of the cellular system working, and you've got enough iodine in there so that the GLUT4 transporters have thyroid hormone that tells it to get busy, and so it does get busy, and it sends out the transporters, and they get stuck in the membrane. They never make it. So what do you do about that?
Well, the trucks are all sitting at the docks, but they can't unload their they can't unload their cargo.
Yeah, the ones that have a cargo can take it on in, but the ones that haven't gotten to the dock to pick up a cargo can't get one, can't get there, because the membrane is too stiff and too sticky. Well, what makes your cell membrane stiff and sticky? Cholesterol is perhaps one of the most vital, most necessary and needed substances in the body. It's produced entirely about 85% of it is produced by the liver. A little of it is produced by every cell in the body can make cholesterol. It is a vital substance. Without an adequate amount of cholesterol, you die quickly. With cholesterol levels, as you grow older, your cholesterol levels tend to increase. Normal cholesterol, healthy cholesterol levels, for someone in their 50s, 40s, and 50s and 60s, range from about 300 up to maybe 500 milligrams per deciliter. Now, that's normal, healthy cholesterol in the aging part of your life. When doctors are forcing cholesterol levels down below 200 milligrams per deciliter by the use of artificial drugs, in my opinion, they're committing a crime for which they should go to jail. That's my opinion about
I'd like to say that that your opinion is based on actual science. There's a book out if people want to read about that, because you haven't written specifically about this, but other people have. There's a book called Cholesterol Myths. That's plural, MYTH'S, Cholesterol Myths. I highly encourage you to read it, and it will explain what he's saying.
It's a swindle. It's a criminal swindle.
Anyway,
that's a digression.
It is. It's very important, though, because the drugs that they give people for cholesterol, for lowering cholesterol, are actually causing people to have diabetes.
It causes heart failure, causes coronary artery disease.
Exactly. So you've got this artificial problem, which is high cholesterol. You know, because it's not really a problem. It's an artificial problem. And we're going to give you drugs for it, but those drugs are going to give you diabetes, heart disease, as you stated. So So knowing what healthy cholesterol levels are is extremely important. And I just want to encourage you guys that are listening that you think, oh, my God, you know, this guy must be a quack or he must be nuts because you can't have that high of cholesterol. Go and study it. Go and study it and research it. Find out, and you'll find out for yourself that what he's saying is true.
But there's a very good reason for it. Cholesterol is almost a universal substance in the body. All of your adrenal hormones are made from cholesterol. The precursor is squalene. Cholesterol turns into squalene, and squalene turns into all 70-some-odd of your adrenal hormones, all right, including cortisol. Cholesterol is used for patching damaged portions of your body, which typically get infected either by inflammation through elevated insulin or fungal overgrowth or one thing or another. Cholesterol is the thing that puts patches on it. For example, cholesterol will patch your coronary artery when it gets damaged to keep it from blowing out. If your coronary artery blows out, ruptures, you die quickly within a couple of minutes of hemorrhagic failure. So cholesterol is extremely important. Cholesterol
going back to what you were saying.
This whole subject of cholesterol got started because I wanted to mention one of its fundamental important properties is it acts like the 2x4s in your house for all of your cell membranes. All your cell membranes use cholesterol as a stiffener. Okay? For example, about 60% or more of your brain is composed of cholesterol. A lot of cholesterol in your brain. Your brain's 90% fat. But these cholesterol stiffeners throughout all the cells of your body, it's this cholesterol that causes the membranes to become stiff. Now remember, when the membranes become stiff and sticky, GLUT4 transporters cannot migrate through it very easily. But the reason is that they become stiff and sticky because of cholesterol isn't because of too much cholesterol, although there is extra cholesterol in a diabetic that's caused by the inflammation. There's a whole bunch of loops here, and I'm trying to enter in these loops to make it clear instead of muddle. When you have high insulin levels and you cause artery damage, this stimulates elevated cholesterol levels. The elevated cholesterol levels also provide too much cholesterol for cellular membrane repair, so it causes stiffening of the cell membranes. And this causes your GLUT4 transporters to lose their migration velocity, and glucose stays in your bloodstream. Insulin resistance develops. So what do you do about that? Well, the reason you have elevated cholesterol is dietary, and it's not because you eat too much cholesterol, because 85% of your cholesterol is made by your liver. You can't change the cholesterol level in your bloodstream by diet, at least not by eating or not eating cholesterol. You can't. You can, if you eat nothing but eggs, which are very high cholesterol, your cholesterol level might go up by 1%. If you eat absolutely nothing that contains cholesterol, your cholesterol level might go down by 1%. So you really can't control your cholesterol levels by diet. Doesn't matter how much cholesterol you eat or don't eat. Your liver is going to regulate the amount of cholesterol in your blood, and it's going to regulate it according to what the body needs. So as you grow older and your cholesterol levels tend to increase because of various inflammatory conditions that develop, one of which we mentioned is due to insulin, as you grow older and these cholesterol levels start to go up, what do you do about it? And why do they go up? Well, the reason they go up is because you have a major deficiency of other fatty acids. You need fatty acids. You need omega-3 fatty acids, for example, to return your cellular membranes to a slippery, non-sticky, slippery type state so that the GLUT4 transporters can migrate through it easily. A deficiency of omega-3 fatty acids is far more fundamental to the insulin resistance problem with membranes than is the cholesterol. You can't really change your cholesterol level because your liver will decide what's going on there. But you can change how cholesterol is used as 2x4s in all your membranes. And you do that by making sure you get an adequate supply of omega fatty acids, omega-3 fatty acids. Prior to the revolution in our fatty acid profile, which is pretty much detailed in my book, prior to that revolution, people had about a 1-to-1 ratio of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. And this kept them pretty healthy and pretty diabetes-free. Well, right now, the typical American diet has upwards of 30-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3s. You got 30 times as much omega-6 as omega-3s. And the omega-3s that help your membranes become slippery and non-sticky. So that's one of the one of the things you can do for insulin resistance is lower your ratio of sticky type fatty acids to slippery type fatty acids, omega-6s to omega-3s. We need to get into this whole fats and oils issue is going to take some time. I don't really think we got the time to do it right now.
I actually scheduled 90 minutes. We have 32 minutes left.
Okay, you want to go for it?
I'm up for it if you are. Otherwise, we can schedule another broadcast. I've got some other comments that I can make. I can easily fill that time if you'd like to cover
the fat.
Well,
I've got some other things I wanted to talk about. Probably we ought to schedule a broadcast for a thorough discussion of fatty acids.
Okay.
There's a lot to it, and
okay.
I hate
so
to
we'll
do a
schedule
poor job
another
by trying to cram it into a few minutes.
Yeah. So we'll schedule a show for the fatty acids. Can we talk now about what causes your blood sugar to go up in the first place to get derailed?
Usually your blood sugar starts getting derailed because of one or more failures in your blood sugar control system. And some of these failures we were talking about were the insulin membrane fluidity, the mineral necessity for developing enzymes. These are the types of things.
So what about things like sugar consumption? Like how much sugar do you eat? Does that matter?
Yeah, it matters. And let's talk about carbohydrates in general.
All right.
The body's you can get some arguments from some people, like Atkins, for example, if he were still alive, about the various roles of fats and carbohydrates as a fuel source for the body. But my observation is that there is a very, very elaborate and complex mechanism for controlling the amount of blood sugar you get from carbohydrates. Also, there's another mechanism that controls the changing of the carbohydrates you eat into fats that can be stored for later use. For example, if you it's the feast or famine situation. If you have a situation where you have plenty of food to eat today, your body doesn't assume that it's always going to have plenty of food, so it stores fat, and fat will be a secondary fuel mechanism that it will use when your diet fails and you don't have any food. So you got these, in my opinion, and I think it's the correct opinion, carbohydrates are the fundamental energy source for your body. Any diet that does not face this squarely is something wrong with it. The diabetic has a very difficult time processing carbohydrates. For this reason, a lot of diabetic diets tell you don't eat carbohydrates. This is nonsense, because this is where your body gets all its energy from. Carbohydrates are not all equal. Some carbohydrates are complex, some are simple, some are fast, some are slow. I like the fast, slow definition of carbohydrates, because it depends on how you digest them. If you eat fast carbohydrates, you get lots of sugar in your bloodstream very quickly, and you get it in your bloodstream sometime before enough insulin can be mobilized to deal with it. This is what happens when you eat sugar. Sugar is a fast carbohydrate. All sugars are. What's a slow carbohydrate, on the other hand, is a carbohydrate that takes a lot of activity on the part of the amylase enzyme system to digest and to break down so that it can be absorbed by the villi and get into your bloodstream. So a slow carbohydrate is the desirable carbohydrate for those who are beginning to become insulin resistant or insulin impaired. As you get into this insulin resistance situation more and more, your pancreas will become tired, it'll become exhausted, and it'll be slow to produce enough insulin. Sometimes it won't be. Just before you have insulin failure and you shift into type 1 diabetes, your pancreas will stop producing insulin. So basically, there are a lot of good reasons why you should favor slow carbohydrates. All of the natural carbohydrates, unprocessed carbohydrates, are slow carbohydrates. They're not fast. You can, some of the fruits have fructose in them, but sugarcane, for example, is where sucrose comes from. And when we were a kid, we used to chop off little pieces of sugarcane and suck on it like candy. Well, you got the minerals in the sugar cane, you got the juices, you got everything else to go with the sucrose, and so it was not straight refined sugar, the white stuff that you get by boiling down 20 gallons of sugar cane juice. So this is why you should favor complex carbohydrates and avoid simple ones. Any refined carbohydrate is a sugar, and it will have very bad effects on your system. It will trigger your system to react much quicker than it can react. There's a time interval between detecting sugar in your portal vein and releasing insulin into your portal vein. There's a time lag there. And if you eat sugar, straight sugar, that time lag won't give enough time for the insulin to correct the sugar imbalance quickly enough. And so your blood sugar will shoot way up. This will force your insulin to shoot way up, and your whole system goes into a hyper mode that it never should get into. Sugar.
One of the ways I picture it is it's like you're building a fire. Say you're barbecuing in your backyard, and you've got a little bit of wood there, and you want a bigger fire. You've got two choices. You can take the lighter fluid and squirt it on it, which it just flames up. Or you can put a log on, you know, and the log obviously is going to not flame up like that, but it's going to burn long and slow. So the more complex carbohydrates are more like the log, and the simple sugars are more like the lighter fluid, right?
That's right. That's okay. Exactly right.
And so when you get that burst of sugar, you get a burst of insulin, and you keep doing that, then you're saying then the pancreas gets tired of doing that. It gets tired of trying to play catch-up with all these bursts of sugar. It gets tired of producing the insulin.
Mm-hmm. It gets exhausted.
People.
And, another very, very bad thing happens when you eat sugar. When I say eat sugar, I'm talking about pastries, candy, donuts, cakes, pies, all kinds
soft drink.
Of... These are all refined, processed foods with high sugar content. Well, there's another thing that happens here, too. And this typically affects the diabetic. After you've been running high sugar levels for a while, and your pancreas is becoming pretty much stressed, there's another thing that happens. In your colon, throughout your body, your intestinal tract consists of your duodenum, your jejunum, your ileum, and your colon. And throughout the length of this tract, you have different areas where different facets of the digestive program take place. And in the colon, the main digestive program process that takes place there is fibers get digested and water gets absorbed. And this is the place where fungus tends to grow. You have, in your colon, you have a fungus. Typically, it's a Candida albicans. It grows in your colon. When you die, this is what causes your body to deteriorate and turn back into dust. It's the fungus in your colon expands because the mechanisms that hold it in check no longer work. So it expands and consumes all the cells of your body. But for the diabetic, for the person who's running high blood sugar, what happens is it encourages this fungus to move up out of the colon. It moves up to the iliac valve into the ileum, and it moves into the jejunum, and moves up into the duodenum. The jejunum and duodenum interface the body, the other side of this part of your intestinal tract, interface with your portal vein. And so when it gets up into this area, these little fungals put down, they take up root on the sides of your intestine, and they put roots down through the intestine into the portal vein, which is where the carbohydrates are digested and the sugar can be found. And so they get into the fungus will migrate into the portal vein. When it gets into the portal vein, it will attack the pancreas. It typically attacks the pancreatic beta cells. It infects them. And when a pancreatic beta cell gets infected by fungus, the immune system comes along like a good garbage collector and collects the infected cell and disposes of it. At this point, the medical community, in their wisdom, notices that the cell has been disposed of by the immune system, and so it says, hey, you got something wrong with your immune system. So it's an autoimmune disease.
Right.
Well, baloney, it's not an autoimmune disease at all. The immune system's doing just what it's supposed to do. It's getting rid of infected cells.
Right.
Well, if it gets rid of enough of these infected cells, and you have insufficient insulin production, then this type 2 diabetes that we've been talking about, insulin-resistant type diabetes, will gradually change and morph into type 1 diabetes, which is the type that has insufficient insulin. Your insulin levels will plummet. Your glucose will remain high, but your insulin levels will plummet. And at this point, when your insulin levels quickly decrease. Within about 3 or 4 weeks span of time, your body weight will plummet. You'll lose 30% of your body weight. If you
because
weigh,
insulin
if you're 300,
helps you store fat.
If you're a 300-pound person, you'll lose 90 to 100 pounds in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks. This is a sign that your pancreas has failed. It's a warning sign that you have been so lax in taking care of your body that you have completely exhausted your pancreas to the point where it doesn't even work anymore. And it also indicates that sometimes your fungus has invaded your portal vein and starts destroying your beta cells. Once this fungus gets into the portal vein, it emits spores, travels all over your body. These spores take up residence everywhere. If they find a likely place in a joint, they'll start to infect the joint. You get a form of arthritis. One woman died of heart failure, and during the autopsy, they discovered that her entire heart was covered with a velvety green material. Turned out to be fungus. Her heart wasn't red like you normally see in a picture. It was covered with a velvety green stuff, fungus. The entire heart. And this fungus had put down roots into the heart muscle.
Wow.
And it was taking all the glucose and sugar that the heart should be getting to power its beating. So she eventually died of heart failure. So one of the interesting things about insulin resistance is if you don't do something about it at some point, it will eventually morph into pancreatic failure, type 1 diabetes, fungus takes over your body. And at that point, things get very, very difficult to take care of because once the fungus gets up into the upper intestine and gets distributed throughout your body, these spores, getting rid of it becomes pretty difficult. It takes it's like a 2-year program. You can typically get your blood sugar control on for diabetes in about 3 or 4 months. Some people get it done in 3 or 4 weeks. And then if you persist and continue with a decent diet, then eventually your insulin levels will also drop down and normalize. You can't really consider your diabetes cured until your insulin also normalizes. And once this happens, you deny this fungus the food that it needs. Fungus lives on sugar. You deny this fungus the food that you need, it needs. And so that's an essential part of getting rid of fungus, is to get control of your diabetes, too. But
and so it requires some consciousness about what you're ingesting as far as simple sugars versus more complex carbohydrates.
Complex carbohydrates are, well, your vegetables are complex carbohydrates. Your low sugar fruits are complex carbohydrates. A lot of nuts and seeds contain complex carbohydrates along with fats and oils. A decent diet, a correct diet, will cure virtually all of the degenerative disease we got in the country, not just diabetes, but a whole lot of other degenerative disease. A lot of men, 50, 60-year-old men, have prostate problems. That's dietary, too.
Right.
The best fix for that is to eat pumpkin seeds. Pumpkin seeds. Many of the ills, degenerative ills that affect us, are totally responsive to diet. We're going to have to, at some point, we're going to have to get into a lot of the details of what constitutes a good diet.
Absolutely. And obviously, we're not going to have enough time for that today. But
well, let me broad brush that. Take a crack at it. Just give you a broad idea.
Sounds good.
First of all, your diet consists of protein, carbohydrates, and fats, fats and oil. Okay. Fats and oils are very essential, not as a fuel source, but as a source for building blocks. The cellular membranes are made out of fats and oils. Your prostaglandin system is made out of fats and oils. Your brain is 90% fats and oils. Your nervous system is all 90% fats and oils. Fats and oils are construction materials. They're like the bricks, the 2x4s, the sheeting. This is what fats and oils do for your body. Fats and oils can be burned as fuel. Okay? But they're a secondary fuel source. Their primary mechanism is not to be fuel, not a body fuel. Their primary source is for construction materials. Carbohydrates are the fuel source for the body. Carbohydrates in the digestive process are broken down into constituents. Constituents are sugars. And the sugars are absorbed and go through this blood sugar control system, end up in the cell, in the mitochondria in the cell, and produce the energy. Proteins are also construction materials and building blocks. Proteins are used for example, the construction of enzymes. All enzymes are proteins. And the process is when you eat proteins, you goes to a catabolic phase where they're broken down into their simple amino acids. Then the amino acids are all recombined to form new proteins, enzymes. This is how it goes. Now, most of these degenerative diseases take time to develop. You don't suffer any real problems with a degenerative disease in a matter of weeks or months. It usually takes years to develop. And the reason is because you have to have years of this nutritional abuse before your body has failed to rebuild your cell membranes, your brain, your enzyme systems, all your protein-based systems, your fat-based systems. Your body has not had the structural materials it has needed to repair everything and keep it in good working order. And this is why you suffer degenerative disease. So what's it going to take to keep things in good working order? Carbohydrates should be the complex carbohydrates that have not just the carbohydrate sugars in them, but also have the various sterols and phytosterols and other chemistry that your body can use as catalyst to cause the construction process to proceed correctly. All right? So any good diet...
Go ahead.
Any good diet is going to consist of whole foods, unprocessed foods. Fats and oils, for example, have what's called a smoke point associated with them. I'll quote you the smoke points for a few fats and oils here, just to give you an idea of what's going on. When you're cooking with a fat or an oil, and it starts to smoke, you have destroyed the nutritional benefit of that fat or oil, and you started it in the process of creating trans fatty acids. Trans fatty acids are produced by overheating an oil or a fat. Give you an idea of some of these smoke points. Corn oil, common oil, 160 degrees C. it'll start to smoke. And when it starts to smoke, it starts to develop trans fatty acids, starts to get destroyed. Many of these oils are vary between 107 degrees and 160 degrees. They're smoke points. Once you develop trans fatty acids, you've essentially got a fatty acid building block in your system that looks much like cholesterol does. It will stiffen your arteries, stiffen your membranes. So it's important when you're cooking with whole foods that you realize some of the limitations in the cooking process and don't overcook or overheat these foods, because heat is often what destroys things. You can take a perfectly good oil like a virgin olive oil and turn it into a toxic trans fatty mess right on your kitchen stove.
Right.
Many people cook with olive oil, and they shouldn't do that without mixing water with it.
What does the water do?
Well, if you mix water and olive oil together and you cook with the mixture cannot get higher than the boiling point of water, which is 100 degrees C, and the boiling point of water starts, when water reaches its boiling point, it starts extracting the additional heat energy into the heat of transformation so that the mixture never gets hotter than the boiling point of water. And at that temperature, the olive oil will not be destroyed or ruined. But if you boil all the water out of the olive oil will continue to go up beyond the boiling point of water. And when it gets high enough, when it reaches its smoke point, it will become completely toxic.
Wow.
Are you with me?
Yes. That's excellent information.
Let's see. What haven't we touched on?
Well, how about fiber?
Well, fiber is an overrated nutrient. Fiber is probably good, particularly soluble fiber. It's probably pretty good for keeping your intestines cleaned out. But it doesn't have any nutritional value. It just cleans your intestines out. And it's probably its biggest value is it'll act like kind of like the amylase inhibitors. The enzyme inhibitors. It will slow down the digestive process. I can just see now that there'll be somebody out there listening to me, and they'll say, "Well, gee whiz, if I put sugar on my fiber, the fiber will slow the sugar down."
Oh, that's funny.
Don't. Take my word, don't.
We're always trying to work the system, you know.
Always trying to work
Great.
The system. If you work the system, you better be very, very smart about how you do it, because I guarantee you the system was put together by somebody that was very, very smart.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
I
know that a lot of people, you know, hear all this and they go, "Oh, it's so complicated." Here's the simplicity of it. You don't have to know how all this works. Your body already knows how to do it. It's designed to function properly. It just needs the right fuel. And we're going to cover that more in the next broadcast. We're going to really cover the fats and oils in depth, because that's a really big issue.
It would take an hour and a half to get through all the fats and oil stuff. There is one thing you mentioned to me earlier when we were talking before the show.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you personally can't handle flax oil, that you're allergic to it.
Yes.
And this is not uncommon. With people, in many cases with diabetic people, they develop allergies, food allergies of various kinds. And the food allergy itself will cause an elevation of blood sugar. Okay? And the
yes.
blood sugar control loop that causes that to happen is you eat something that you to which you're allergic. Your body goes into an emergency mode. Your adrenals secrete cortisol, amongst a few other adrenaline and a few other things. The cortisol triggers your liver to dump sugar. That's why your blood sugar goes up when you have an allergic reaction. Now, flax oil is a very important oil for a whole lot of reasons. We touched on a couple of them. But some people are allergic to flax oil, and you told me you were.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do about that? Well, there's a bunch of things you can do about it. First, try eating flax seed. Sometimes when you press the oil out of these seeds, it becomes too potent. It produces overwhelming results to a sensitive system. So you might first try eating the seed instead of taking the oil. Now, if you take the oil, you would take about 1 to 2 tablespoons of it a day. All right? If that still doesn't cure the allergic problem, then you've got some other options of things that contain omega-3 fatty acids. For example, hemp seed oil, chia oil. There's a candle nut or cocoa type oil that you can get. Pumpkin seeds. I recommend pumpkin seeds, particularly for men. Eat a handful of pumpkin seeds every day, and you'd be surprised what it'll do for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
But pumpkin seeds have omega-3 fatty acids.
Well, we
cold
have
water
three
fish.
Minutes. We have 3 minutes left, and so I'd like to just make sure we've got some good information for the listeners. For one thing, I want you to know that his book is called Insulin, Our Silent Killer, and that's available directly from Mr. Smith. You can email him if you want. Let's see, I've got your email here in front of me. If you've got a pen and paper, you can find him at Valley at, F as in Frank, R as in Roger, II.com. So it's Valley at FRII.com. You can contact him there, and he can give you information about how to get his book. He can ship it out to you directly. Stay tuned. We will send another broadcast email blast out there letting you know when the next broadcast is, because we thought we could get more done in this hour and a half than we did. This information is just so vast, and his knowledge base is so vast. I'm excited about doing another show just on the oils. It's a big deal. You know, he talked about the fungal part of diabetes, and, you know, a lot of people with diabetes subsequently get diagnosed with the heart disease and with cancer, and they've proven that cancer has a fungal factor to it, and there's just so much to cover, and so we want you to stay tuned. Because by the time you're done with this, once you've read his book and you've listened to these broadcasts, you're going to be able to take control back. You're going to be able to turn this thing around. The Titanic doesn't have to sink. You know, you can keep this thing going. You can become completely free of all these symptoms, and you can feel good in your body. You can have the energy that you need.
I might point out on my website.
Yes.
A lot of this information is on my website. You can go.
Absolutely. Healingmatters.com, correct?
www.healingmatters.com. And
yeah,
you'll find a lot of the stuff we talk about here on the website. And a lot of people, what they've been doing is they've been downloading my website and printing it out. They make little books out of
yeah.
it.
Absolutely. You can do that.
It's a good reference book. It'll give you the connecting link between a lot of these ideas that we're talking about here.
Yes, and you can go to donnacrow.wordpress.com That's www.donnacrow.wordpress.com, and there's also information there. There's an article that Mr. Smith wrote that's excellent. He's coming out with a new article. So we've got like 18 seconds here, so I just want to say, hey, you know, guys, thanks for listening. Share this with your friends and family because it's going to set them free. Stay tuned because we will be back again very soon, and we'll do another broadcast and finish this off. God bless you all.
God bless.